So I'm Pat Schnabel. I'm a professor at Iowa State University. I also direct the Center for Plant Genomics here. I knew from an early age that I wanted to study plants. It was actually an article in a kid's magazine, Highlights, which introduced me to the work of Luther Burbank, who was a plant breeder around the turn of the last century. And he made a lot of interspecific crosses and generated populations with a lot of genetic variability in them, and then was able to select new varieties of fruits and vegetables. And that really excited me. And I've tracked down a book about him in the library and read about this. Was all when I was younger than 10. So I initially thought I wanted to be a plant breeder. But once I got into grad school, I realized that my interests were really more basic biological questions. And so since then, I've spent essentially all of my professional life, about 30 years now, studying maize genetics and maize genomics. I work on maize for these questions because it's a great model for genetics. There's also a great scientific community, the maize genetics community, and it's also an important crop, corn is, maize. And so the basic findings that we come up with can be readily applied to the public good. During my PhD with Peter Peterson, I studied a highly active DNA transposon system of maize called Mutator, using classical genetic approaches. And later, as a postdoc with Heinz Seidler at the Max Planck Institute in Cologne, Germany, I began to study this transposon system using what at the time were new tools of molecular biology. But when I was done with the postdoc, I accepted a faculty position at Iowa State University, which is where I've been since. And I've got a fairly diverse group that we study a wide range of basic biological and genetic processes, all in maize, using a lot of genetic approaches, as well now as genomics and computational biology. So the paper that I'm going to discuss today is entitled All Possible Modes of Gene Action Are Observed in a Global Comparison of Gene Expression in a Maize F1 Hybrid and Its Inbred Parents. This was published in PNAS May 2nd, 2006. The authors were Ruth Swanson-Wagner, Yi Jia, Rhonda DeCook, Lisa Borsuk, Dan Nettleton, and myself. Now, Dan Nettleton is a professor of statistics here at Iowa State. He's an expert in the design and analysis of microarray experiments, among his many other talents. And my group and his have a joint lab meeting every week. So my biology students really get a very immersive experience in statistics while they're here. And this really is one of the highlights of the week for all of us. So Dan was the natural collaborator for this project, and it is a true collaboration. I mean, it was every week we were looking at data together and discussing how to design the experiment and then how to analyze the data. Ruth Swanson-Wagner, Yi Jia, and Lisa Borsuk are all biology students. Ruth and Yi were PhD students. Lisa was a master's student. And Rhonda DeCook was a statistics PhD student with Dan Nettleton. Ruth is now a postdoc with Nathan Springer at the University of Minnesota, where she's continuing to study gene expression. Yi's going to graduate in August with his PhD, and Rhonda is now an assistant professor at not Iowa State University, but the University of Iowa. So the paper concerns heterosis. Heterosis is the fundamental basic biological phenomena that if certain parents are crossed together, the progeny, the hybrids, outperform either parent. Now, this was observed a long time ago in many different species, but it really, the sort of discovery of heterosis and its application is credited to George Shull, who was working at Cultural Harbor around the turn of the century. But in 1908, he published. Now, he was doing fundamental basic science, and as sort of an accident, he discovered heterosis of maize. And this has become the foundation for much of the seed industry around the world, and it has contributed enormously to increased agricultural productivity. So it's a great example of how basic research can contribute to the public good. Nowadays, most of the corn grown in the U.S. and around the world is hybrid. What that means is seed companies identify inbred parents, so completely homozygous lines, and they look for pairs, combinations of two, that when crossed together produce very productive hybrids, and this is one of the things seed companies do. So it's a key technology, not only for maize, but any essentially all of the cross-pollinated crops. But we don't understand how it works. At a fundamental basic level, we don't understand heterosis, and we haven't understood it for the last 100 years. The way the seed companies identify parents is almost, not quite, but almost trial and error. So they have some general rules, and they pick inbreds, and they make crosses between them. And then they conduct large replicated field trials to see which ones do well. And when they find a winner, they bulk up the seed and they market that. Now, if we could understand this phenomenon of heterosis, the seed companies would be able to focus their testing resources on a limited number of inbreds, those that are likely to be most successful, and that would speed genetic gain, increasing crop yields, and doing all sorts of good things. So, trying to understand heterosis or hybrid vigor has been a very long-standing challenge, and a lot of people have worked on it over the last 100 years. Two major models have emerged for heterosis. One is called dominance, and the other is called overdominance. So dominance, according to that model, what happens is when we cross two inbreds together, they both contain unfavorable alleles at certain loci, but if the unfavorable alleles are at different loci in the two inbreds, when they're crossed together, those unfavorable alleles will be complemented by dominance, and the F1 progeny, the hybrid, will perform better than either parent. Overdominance suggests that it is the heterozygosity per se, so that the two parents differ, they have different alleles at many loci, and when they're crossed together in the hybrid, we have heterozygotes at many loci, and that heterozygosity, there's something about that heterozygosity per se that makes the plant or organism better than either parents. Previously, heterosis had been studied before the recent decade or so. Heterosis had been mainly studied at the level of phenotypic traits. So scientists could make crosses of inbreds and observe that the progeny they were taller, or they flowered earlier, or they had higher grain yield. They exhibited heterosis. But it was really difficult to distinguish between these two models. So the advent of microarray technology and the availability of cDNA clones and some other tools allowed us to dissect the patterns of gene expression that were responsible for these heterotic phenotypes. So to do this, we built a custom cDNA array, and then we measured gene expression using the cDNA array in two inbreds, B73 and Missouri 17, as well as the F1 hybrid obtained by crossing these two inbred lines together. And we did this in a highly replicated experimental design that allowed us to detect even small differences in gene expression. Now, what we found was that all modes of gene expression could be detected. And this is a really large data set, and it's a very complicated one to describe. And figure 2 in the PNAS paper does this beautifully. Well, I'll get to it a little later. I'll get to talking about that figure in particular. But first, I want to say the different modes of gene expression. So additive gene expression is where the level of transcript, as detected by the cDNA microarray, in the hybrid is exactly intermediate to the two parents. So if the two parents, B73 and Missouri 17, have different accumulations of mRNA, the F1 hybrid is exactly intermediate. That would be additive gene expression. Dominant gene expression would be where the transcript level in the hybrid is equal to either the higher or the lower of the two parents. And overdominant and underdominant expression patterns are where the transcript accumulation in the hybrid is higher than both parents or lower than both parents. So it's extreme. It's more extreme than either parent. And what we saw was all possible modes of gene expression. And based on these results, we concluded that either dominance or overdominance could contribute to heterosis, or more likely, both of them do. There had been a lot of support in the early years for overdominance, and then the mood of the community shifted, and dominance became a more favored model. But this paper provided at least support for the overdominant model. And my personal view is both of these are, in fact, acting, as well as probably mechanisms that aren't well described by either one of those models. But it is interesting to note that Danny Zamir from Israel has recently published a very exciting report of a single gene mutation that supports overdominance. So whenever a paper is successful like this one, you wonder why, what is it about it that made it work? And this one was asking an important question. It's a question that people have been wondering about for a century. And new tools came online that allowed us to address that question. It was a very well-designed experiment with lots of replication and appropriate statistical analysis, so people believed the results. But I think this figure 2 that I mentioned was a really important contributor to why the paper was so successful. I've been heavily influenced by the books of Edward Tufte. He's written a whole series of books. The first one one, I think, was called the visual display of quantitative information. But his basic point is, if you can find a way to present complex data in an intuitive sense, people will get it, and they'll be able to make good decisions based on the data. If the data are stuck in an Excel table, a lot of people just won't get the point, and bad decisions will sometimes take place because of that, the lack of information. So I can't take credit for the idea behind Figure 2. That was certainly Dan Nettleton came up with how to display these informations. My collaborator, Dan Nettleton, came up. But Tufte's work encouraged our team to find some way to display these rather complex data in a manner that readers would find intuitive. And I believe we were very successful with that, and I think this contributed to the success of the paper because people could get it. Figure 2 really is the point of the whole paper, and in that one figure, people got it. We've had lots of people write to us and ask us for the computer code on how to generate a figure like that so they can present their own data that way. So since this paper was published, we've continued to study this question of gene expression in hybrids, and this particular paper has led us into a couple new directions. First, we became interested in the genetic control of differential gene expression patterns that we observed in this PNAS paper. So we conducted an EQTL study. So EQTL, or expression QTL, is a technology for mapping the genetic determinants that control variation in traits. And we were interested in understanding, you know, where on the chromosomes are the genes or the regulatory regions that control differential expression. And this was, again, a very large, well-designed experiment, again, conducted in collaboration with Dan Nettleton. And we identified about 4,000 EQTL, most of which acted in trans, which means the regulatory region that controlled expression was not closely linked to the gene whose expression was being controlled. And this was a result that overturned some of the published literature but makes a lot more intuitive sense. Because we have so much replication and so much ability to detect small differences, I believe this result, and the community does too, I think. But the really interesting thing that we learned in this follow-up study was that for many of the trans EQTL, it turns out the gene expression patterns in the hybrid appear to be completely regulated by the QTL, the EQTL allele, that was contributed by the paternal parent. And that was a really surprising study. I mean, this is a massive epigenetic non-Mendelian behavior that had previously gone undetected in, as far as we know, any species on the scale. This study was published in the November 20th issue of Science, and Ruth Swanson Wagner was also the first author of this paper. The second direction that this PNAS paper took us in was that as a result of writing that paper, we strengthened our ties with Nathan Springer at the University of Minnesota. He was conducting similar research at the same time we were, and we published or submitted papers about the same time, and that brought the two groups together for lots of discussions. And collaborating with Nathan led, along with some other developments, to collaborations with Jeff Jedlow at Roche Nimblegen and Brad Barbazook at the University of Florida. And with these guys, we did a rather interesting study. We took advantage of the draft sequence of the maize genome, which was also published in the November 20th issue of Science, and to design a Nimblegen microarray, which contained 1.2 million probes designed from the low copy regions of the genome, focusing on the genes. And so we conducted comparative genome hybridization, or CGH, experiments on B73, Missouri 17, and the F1 hybrid, which are the same genetic materials we used for the PNAS study that we're focusing on today. And we discovered something really quite surprising. In humans and mammals, there's been a fair bit of work on what are called copy number variations. So these are changes in the number of copies in genetic elements, and called CNVs. So we analyzed our comparative genome hybridization data from maize, and we found hundreds of copy number variants that affected genes. This is unprecedented among higher eukaryotes. It's a much higher level of structural variation. We also discovered something which we've now termed PAVs, although it's a subset of copy number variation. PAVs are presence-absence variation. And again, we found several hundred single-copy genes which are simply missing in some inbreds compared to other inbreds. And this is truly a striking result. And it may help explain the structural variation, this high level of structural variation, may help explain some of the diversity in gene expression patterns that we reported in this PNAS paper that we're talking about today. The third direction this study led us into, one of the co-first authors of the PNAS paper, Yi Jia, has used three different technologies now to study the accumulation of natural antisense transcripts in maize. And he's shown that there are a very large percentage of genes have natural antisense transcripts that accumulate in them. And that the natural antisense transcripts that accumulate in maize differ from inbred to inbred. So that when we generate hybrids, we actually create a novel spectrum of antisense transcripts in that hybrid relative to either inbred parent. And because antisense transcripts can influence gene expression, this diversity in the accumulation of natural antisense transcripts may also help explain some of the variation in gene expression that we observed in the PNAS paper. So at the PNAS paper, this Swanson-Wagner paper was a great launching pad for a number of investigations for the lab. Thank you.